This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Bill Hanna has made the transition from being the president and CEO of the Northwest Indiana Regional Development Authority to a new role as executive director of the Dean and Barbara White Family Foundation based in Merrillville. And we're going to have a chance to find out more about not only the foundation itself, how it's been doing lately, but some of the plans for the future and the priorities. And first, as we get started, we should tell you Lakeshore Public Radio gets a grant from the Dean and Barbara White Family Foundation. And Bill, thank you very much for being with us on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us about the transition that you've made from one major organization to another, kind of narrowing the scope, but still very much concerned with the well-being of residents here in Northwest Indiana.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, it felt like a natural fit. It's still Northwest Indiana, you know, Lake and Porter counties, primarily Lake County.
Mm-hmm.
But we had gotten to the place with the RDA where we had achieved full funding of the Westlake Corridor expansion and the double track project through the FTA. And that was all, you know, announced fairly recently. And that was something I wanted to stay in the position at the RDA, the CEO position, until those projects were complete and we had delivered on what we said we were going to do. And so it felt like a good time to make a transition as well. And so those projects, you know, they're beginning construction here pretty immediately, and they'll be working on those for the next 5 years, building them out. And you know, I always kind of felt like in a position like that, you should stay as long as you can perform the mission in the way that you know, put it out and complete that vision. And once that's done, it's a public function, and it's probably somebody else's time to take it to the next level. Mm-hmm. And bring some different level of foresight into it and that kind of thing. So I think it was a good time to leave for those couple of reasons, but I always wanted to stay involved in what was going on in my home area. And this opportunity with the Dean and Barbara White Family Foundation was a very unique one, and to me, a very important one with a lot of potential.
I know that it is a prominent foundation. In fact, the name literally is prominent now. It's on the sign for the Dean and Barbara White Family Foundation Community Center, which is located in Merrillville. But there's probably not many people that really know the function of the foundation. Will you go through some of the strategic priorities that the foundation is set up and functions with, and look at the future?
That center is a great example, and of course a very recent one, where you know, we're really looking for economic development impacts, sustainability, region-wide benefits, and the matching sort of elements, you know, partnerships. And so we believe in partnerships, and we did at the RDA as well. You know, when people make investments in themselves and they're side-by-side at the table with you, that produces, in a lot of cases, sustainability. Everybody's rowing in the same direction, and resources have been put up, and everyone cares enough to make that happen. And in that example of the community center, you have that on the financial side for starters. The town really stepped up. They're redeveloping a property that wasn't at its best and highest use. And so that approaches your economic development potential. There's a lot of traffic created coming in and out of a place like this, and it should benefit local businesses and create a town center environment for Merrillville. And then, you know, within the confines of what goes on inside, you have all ages in attendance, and really geared toward health and wellness and safety, education, and again, a sense of community. And so, you know, from seniors to children. And so these things become very powerful. And I think, you know, when you talk to the members of the White family, they're looking for these kinds of things. And so in interacting with Bruce, we were talking about that facility in the sense that, you know, he's always been, and the family's been involved in, they've created a lot of venues, you know, and but the magic of the venue, it's like he was saying, it's you know, like his dad would have viewed it as a house. And the magic happens when the family comes together within the house. That's really what the venue is about. It's mm-hmm. facilitating interaction, you know, in an atmosphere where people exchange ideas and they grow, and there's excitement, and there's high points of their lives happening within these things. And so the center represents, you know, a project that brings that together, as do the YMCA projects. You know, Purdue, the Union Center, the hotel there, you know, interaction with these larger interactions with the larger institutions that you know, bring these important elements in place. And so you can see examples of what I'm talking about throughout what they've done so far. And again, you know, the latest being the community center, really, it's really a timely thing to look at and see where this all comes together.
Mm-hmm. And I know in the case of the community center in Merrillville, it's taking a piece of land and turning it into its best possible uses, even though it's stayed in the way as a recreational facility, or at least a community facility, as for people that happen to remember, that used to be the site of a drive-in theater not so many decades ago that went bust and laid fallow for so many years. And finally, that was the opportunity for the town of Merrillville to be able to create it into something that everybody in the community can take advantage of.
Right. Yeah. And it's a beautiful thing when you can really jump into that space and do something that, again, it's not really about brick and mortar. It gives it an opportunity to house what goes on inside, and that energy and that focus and that attendance and repetition of being there and just being accustomed to that being such a place of positivity, it has to have a positive impact on properties that are adjacent to it and the town itself. It's also region-wide, you know. I mean, this facility is going to draw people from all over the region.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just good for Northwest Indiana. You know, when we start really focusing on what we have in common and sharing things together that are important to us, you know, activities like sports involving kids, arts, you know, just general activity, health and wellness, like I said before. You see things come out of that build strong communities. That's part of it is important to the future, and it creates its own thing.
And as you mentioned earlier about the fact that the foundation's very supportive of organizations that support well-being of residents and recreation and other types of activities. But you go back to the work that has been done, the support from the foundation for the new South Lake YMCA in Crown Point.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible, if you've been there, if you haven't, I encourage you to go look. And it happens throughout that YMCA system. I was with the city of Valparaiso when they moved the Y out of downtown and on the north side, and we were doing redevelopment project up there.
Uh-huh.
And it breathes life into areas. And again, you know, it has all the elements that the community center in Merrillville has as well, in terms of it's not just about sports. You know, it's a community center. It's health and wellness. It's for all ages. It's an amenity that puts a town on a map sometimes. It's just an attractive feature to people who want to move in. It has a positive effect on your real estate values. And it's a tremendous thing, and it just speaks to the idea that quality of life pieces and amenities are important to human beings. We need to interact with each other. We need these things, and it makes the community attractive in so many ways, and it builds sustainability of quality of life in. People, you know, they hold these things up and they make them work because they're important.
We're talking with Bill Hanna. He's executive director of the Dean and Barbara White Family Foundation, which is based here in Merrillville. We're also talking about various topics and areas of concern that the foundation has been involved in and looking to the future. And you talked earlier, Bill, about the fact that the foundation has helped out with Purdue University on some major projects, in particular the historic Union Club Hotel down on the West Lafayette campus. And I guess that fits in very nicely with the fact that the family has been certainly involved in lodging, the fact the family White Lodging is still out there as a brand and with activities and with properties all around the country, I guess. And so it's not surprising that the foundation would want to support Purdue University as they try to upgrade a very, very famous and very busy facility down there on campus.
These things are so important from the standpoint of, if you step back a little ways and kind of take a strategic look at what goes on, which is what we're going to be doing moving forward, especially is laying things out where we can really anticipate a broad impact. This one in particular, you know, you're partnering with a world-class and world-known organization and institution at Purdue University. It's an ambassador in a lot of ways for the state of Indiana to the world, as is IU and other things like that, but certainly Purdue. And we have a regional campus presence as well. And so the relationship beyond just the projects themselves with these institutions are incredibly important, and there's synergy created when you bring these things together and you pull in the same direction. And, of course, you know, like you said, the intersection of what the White family has done so well over time and the generosity, it can be seen in this project. It's neat to see a culmination of those things where you have the lodging aspect of it, which is, again, more about human beings and interaction than it is just staying somewhere, and then where it's located. The intersection of that in Purdue University, a place that does research and development and leads the world in so many areas, and such an impact on the state broadly, too. I love seeing these kinds of investments made and gifts made where, again, it's not just about you're getting the sustainability, but you're getting the power of that institution with it, too, and the effect on so many lives going forward for so long.
The foundation has been working very hard over the last year or so to do its part to help lessen the impact of the coronavirus pandemic on not only associates of White Lodging, but the communities as well here in the region. With that in mind, are there any other things that the foundation is interested in or going to be working on to help deal with the situation? We're still in the pandemic. We still have issues to deal with economically and socially. And anything that the foundation is looking at and trying to help do?
Yeah, we're in the process right now of looking at our strategic plan. Mm-hmm. And so we would be looking at things that are long term, like we've been talking about in terms of facilities and grants and so forth. And we're also looking at alignment of institutions to see how can we all participate as 501c3s in a way that we're all filling the right lanes and taking advantage of the expertise we all provide and moving together with the idea being that the people that will benefit is the objective, the primary. And then you have short-term issues, which shorter-term issues, which the pandemic is, of course, dragged on longer than we'd like and that mm-hmm. kind of thing. But, you know, the idea that we would come out of this here fairly quickly and then be able to use these facilities that are being created without impediment. So I think that's an issue that we'll keep an eye on for sure and look for opportunities to be helpful in as we go forward. It does relate to, like I say, ultimately, it does relate to what we're creating elsewhere, places for people to be together.
That's very true. Well, it seems that the Dean and Barbara White Foundation is going to keep a close eye on not only the pandemic and the impact, but also all the other projects that are worthy in Northwest Indiana to get support. And Bill Hanna, thank you very much for spending time going over the projects and bringing us up to date. And the best of luck to you and everybody involved with the foundation in helping keep Northwest Indiana not only healthy, but the well-being rising and economic rising as well, too. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
This is Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Despite the pandemic, casinos across the country are still seeing a lot of traffic. They raked in more than $1 billion in the first 3 months of this year, matching their best quarter ever. That interest in placing bets is at full peak in our area as well, as the newest casino to enter the competitive market opened in Gary on Friday. But some people are also concerned about how a future Chicago casino might affect Gary's bid to turn its fortunes around. WBEZ Radio's Michael Puente has a report.
The glitz of Hollywood, the shine of Las Vegas, the larger-than-life guitar outside the gleaming new $325 million Hard Rock Casino, Northwest Indiana's first and only land-based casino.
The location is phenomenal, but the brand and the property itself, I think, are going to separate itself from the rest of the market.
That's Matt Schuford, president of the 200,000-square-foot Hard Rock Casino, Northern Indiana.
This is an incredible opportunity for the city of Gary. For them to have what is being built and the team and the brand and the facility that's going to be in the city of Gary, these are exciting times.
From Wish TV, Indianapolis.
Gary's had exciting times before, like 30 years ago when Indiana lawmakers first began the process of allowing gambling in the state.
The city of Gary, Indiana is rolling the dice again this evening.
Tim Shella is at the State House now with the latest in this historic debate. The casino measure is being sold as a Gary rescue bill, and promoters are saying that it will create more benefit than a lottery or parimutuel betting.
Gary was the first city in Indiana to get casinos with two gambling ships on Lake Michigan's southern shore. It brought millions to a city starving for new investment. And jobs and revenues were generated in big ways, says Scott King, who came into office as Gary's mayor the same year the boats arrived.
When the boats came in, it was job creator. The funds the city share of revenues generated be for capital expenditures, you know, equipment purchases, construction, demolition.
The city purchased new police cars, fire equipment, fixed some streets, and made needed infrastructure repairs. But then moves by state lawmakers, including giving huge tax breaks to U.S. Steel and changes to how property taxes were collected, Gary was forced to use its windfall on basic necessities.
As time marched on, this capital funding source really, really, really got diminished because of actions by the state legislature. The bloom faded somewhat in a fairly short period of time.
The Gary Rescue Plan never materialized in ways state lawmakers and Gary officials hoped. But the casinos have lived up to the hype, generating nearly $400 million for Gary over the last 25 years. King, who left office in 2006, says he still sees casinos as a good thing for the city, even if revenues are spent on items that aren't visible to the public. He fears, however, that money may not always be there.
Is it a good thing to have? Yes, it is. This isn't going to be a magical fix for everything. You know, I remain concerned for all of Northwest Indiana on the casino revenue side with the development of casinos in Chicago.
And that's the elephant in the room. If and when Chicago gets a casino, how it impacts Northwest Indiana's cash cow industry by luring away customers. Plus, with the advent of online sports betting, it's making brick-and-mortar casinos everywhere work harder, says Ed Feigenbaum, who's been covering the gambling industry in the Midwest for decades for Indiana Gaming Insight.
You know, now that you've got gaming literally on every corner and on everybody's, you know, living room couch because of mobile sports wagering, you know, you've really got to offer a special product to get people to come out and play.
Feigenbaum says Hard Rock is entering a very competitive, mature, but uncertain marketplace with long-established operations in three nearby cities and in Southwest Michigan. But he says Hard Rock isn't going to shy away from that.
Hard Rock is going to put in a very strong, competitive product. And they're investing a great deal of money. They're sparing no expense. They've got a great brand and a great reputation. It's really going to be a different kind of experience.
It already is for some Gary residents, like Rodney Lewis, who is optimistic that Hard Rock will deliver in ways not seen here before.
It's a rebirth because you've got the branding of Hard Rock, and it adds an almost instant feeling of legitimacy when a company like Hard Rock comes here to bring in entertainment, and it's almost like a revitalization of the area.
Oh, I think it's going to be great.
Another Gary resident, Karen Williams, thinks the new casino will be a boon for local entertainers.
It expands the whole region's view of entertainment, bringing a little bit of Las Vegas showy stuff to the region.
And unlike the other casino properties nearby, Hard Rock has reached out to the community to attract local vendors, like Erica Buchanan, who runs a Gary-based skincare company. She hopes to sell some of her products in Hard Rock Casino's gift shops.
I think the opportunities could possibly be endless because they're Hard Rock International. So hopefully that we can get Gary residents in and they can see how hard we work, and they will want to take us to different places, maybe overseas somewhere one day.
Hard Rock Casino opens its door to the public on Friday at 5 p.m. following its customary guitar smash. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Michael Puente.
The theme of the new casino is music and of Gary's most famous musical family, the Jackson 5. One of the people who was important in Michael Jackson's young life was his second grade music teacher, Anita Hill. I spoke briefly with the retired educator as we sat down in one of the casino's cafes during Friday's grand opening. Ms. Hill, tell us just a little bit about yourself, about being a teacher, and if you will take some time and tell us about the class on which you met Michael Jackson as a student in second grade.
I'm a music teacher, and when I came to the city, my first job was at Garnet Elementary School. And fortunately, I had all the people in the building, and when I heard this young voice in my class, I turned around and it was a boy named Michael. So I had him to sing for me in the classroom. His only interest was music. And I had put him in my choir, even though he was too young. I had upper grades, and he sung in the choir, and I taught him to sing Climb Every Mountain. After that, I presented him on a PTA program for everybody, and his parents heard him sing for the very first time. And they made him part of the Jackson 5. That's how I first was with Michael Jackson.
Tell us what you recall about meeting Michael. What kind of a young boy was he that even before you heard him sing?
He was a very nice kid and very quiet. And it, unfortunately, in the evening when school was out, the entire family had to go home. But the father was very strict, which was good. It turned out to be fine. And after I met Michael, he was so interested in music, not academics. So I had to make him be interested in academics. That's how he became part of the choir. But he was a very nice kid.
Well, obviously, he must have caught on, even though he was a great singer, at least even early. You say he wasn't, I guess, the best student. You had to help him along to make sure he got his lessons right and all?
Yes, the very first song I taught him, I had to do it by rote because he was really still too young to read. But by learning that, he began to learn how to go to reading class every day, which was very good.
Now, through the years, after he left your classes, basically, got older, went into other grades at school. What do you recall, and even talking with your fellow teachers back then, what was he like later as he got older and got more proficient, even before he started to be with his brothers to form the group?
He was very quiet, and he loved his brothers, and they began to see that he was interested in music, so they began to help him also. They were a little older. Now, the main thing I noticed about Michael, he never objected to anything you told him. Whatever you said, he would do it. If you said sit down, he would sit down. And one day, I will never forget this, we were having choir rehearsal, and the principal called on the intercom and said, no choir. Michael got up and started marching around the building saying, we want choir, we want choir. So he was very different.
Now, as he got older, as he grew up here, I'm sure you've been able to kind of follow him. You certainly can by the media, by reading the newspapers and listening to his records later. How do you remember Michael Jackson?
I remember because there was a program at the stadium in Gary, and he had to be the lead singer, and he came out all dressed and everything and was very good, and he catered to the people in Gary. I was very fascinated with that.
Mrs. Hill, thank you very much for being with us and for giving us some of your memories of Michael Jackson when he was in your music class in grade school, and you remember him later. Thank you very much.
I enjoyed the meeting. Thank you very much. Enjoy your life.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Well, as the restrictions lifted over time, we're going to find more opportunities, if we haven't done so yet, to get out and do a little touring in Northwest Indiana and the entire Midwest region, for that matter. That means that organizations like Indiana Dunes Tourism is going to be very busy once again. They've sat aside because of the pandemic, and let's find out what's happening lately. Lorelei Weimer is the executive director of Indiana Dunes Tourism, and she's with us from the office there along the lake. Thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Chris, for having us.
What seem to be the things that have affected not only your operation, Indiana Dunes Tourism, but just tourism in general here in the Midwest, certainly because of the pandemic?
Well, it had a huge effect. Overnight, worldwide, our industry was really impacted. You know, we're composed of attractions and hotels and restaurants, and certainly when those stay-at-home orders happened, you know, those businesses were greatly impacted. But one of the things that we found that was helpful to us in our area, in Porter County and in Northwest Indiana, is that people needed to do something, you know, and they wanted to do something that would allow them to continue to be safe, but able to get out of the house. And so they were able to come and enjoy the national park and the state park. And we have so many wonderful trails and the beaches and so forth. And so they were able to, they found us. Some people discovered us because of the pandemic, because our parks never closed during this time. And so people were able to come and safely recreate outdoors and be able to enjoy time with nature, which maybe somebody hadn't done for a while.
Did you find that when things closed up in Illinois, and of course we're not closed here in Indiana, that folks made the trip across the state line, and that led to a lot of more attendees to show up at various events, the ones that were still being held, and just the attractions at the lakefront show?
Yeah, mainly what we saw is almost all of our events across the board were canceled, and so it was mainly just coming to experience the dunes and our hiking trails. Not only within the dunes, but outside the dunes at some of our other parks, because it was something that you could do safely. Certainly with Chicago closing, we were not anticipating them closing as long as they did for the season. And so that brought over a lot more people that were coming over. We did have some issues, and I'm not going to say that we didn't have issues. There were definitely some issues, and there were some activities that were not activities that we could tolerate. And so we did have to, in June, we had to get law enforcement involved, because this is a family destination and it's a great destination. And so we wanted to make sure that people understood that that kind of behavior was not going to be tolerated. So there was more people than we anticipated at some time, but we had to work through those issues. But at the end of the day, a lot of people rediscovered state parks all over the state of Indiana, not just in our area. And I think they reconnected with nature, which is a very positive outcome.
You mentioned the state parks in particular. Of course, Indiana Dunes Tourism in the name includes two parks. One of them is, of course, the Indiana Dunes State Park, and the other, of course, is the Indiana Dunes National Park. What was the impact on tourism that you noted, certainly at the outset after the big name change, and how has it been able to carry through even to today?
Yeah, so the National Park saw an increase of 21% in attendance in 2019 because of that name change. And because people confuse the two parks and don't realize they actually have a state park that's surrounded by the national park, they too saw an increase, I think, in revenue by 8% in 2019. So that name change was significant, Chris. But then the pandemic coming on the heels of the name change and people looking for those outdoor opportunities, it increased even more. So the awareness. And so I think what people have realized is that we have this wonderful asset. We are now, some of the issues is that people came and then they went back home right away, and that didn't translate into them going into, eating at our restaurants or going to our hotel. So we still suffered in those areas, but we didn't suffer as great as we could have if we'd have been a big urban area like the Chicago's and the Indianapolis. But both of them have really reconnected people to nature, and recognizing that we're surrounded by urban areas, that to have a national park this close to an urban area is such a positive to introduce people to the wonderful worlds of the national parks and the state parks.
Let's shift to today, and now that we're near the edge, I suppose we could say, of the maybe towards the end of the pandemic, as things improve with the mass vaccination and fewer cases showing up. What are you finding with response from businesses? Have they been able to start to bounce back from the pandemic to be able to be prepared for more people showing up this summer?
Yes. I mean, our people, our restaurants and our attractions, I think they're excited to get back to normal of what that looks like. Certainly, we're seeing some of the issues that they are seeing across the country in terms of being able to hire help. But a lot of our places are ready to get back to normal and be able to safely do that. And I think that's been the message throughout this entire time for us, has been, wanting people to come back, but at the same time, remember to be safe, not only for themselves, but also for the businesses as well. And we've got some new programs that we're launching this year that I think is going to be a really good fit. Chris, still, engaging with that outdoor, safe outdoor recreation and attractions, but also, getting people excited to explore our communities, because it's really important that we get people to spend the night at our hotels, shop at our shops, eat at our restaurants, and go to our other attractions, because it's all of that together that formulates a really good destination. And so we want to make sure our businesses get back to thriving like they were prior to the pandemic.
What kind of programs that you just mentioned that are going to be in place here in Northwest Indiana within Indiana Dunes Tourism to attract people back into the region and not only that, but back into the restaurants and the hotels and other out places that people have visited?
Well, the first one that we're excited about is the Indiana Dunes Flower Quest. And, you know, we are the fifth most biodiverse national park in the country. And we have over 1,100 flowering species. And, you know, these species start to bloom in the spring and then just continue on through fall. And that's what's great. What you're going to see in April is going to be completely different than what you're going to see in May. And so if you go to our website, indianadunes.com, and go to Flower Quest, it's going to tell you that you just click on May, and it's going to tell you all the different flowers you can go see. One of the things we have to caution people is that when you do hike, you need to stay on the trails, and you are not allowed to take anything out of the state park or the national parks or any of our parks throughout the county. You need to leave it there. It's there to look and appreciate, but it's not there to take. But I think people will be amazed at the beauty of the flowers that we have in our area. So that's number one. The second one is the Diana the Dunes Dare, and that is at West Beach. I think sometimes people forget about this beautiful asset that we have at West Beach, which is right on County Line Road between Porter and LaPorte and Lake County. And it's less than a mile hike, and it's really about a challenge. And it's also, Chris, about retelling a ghost story about Diana of the Dunes, which is really the life of Alice Mabel Gray, who is from Chicago. And it's a great opportunity to get a wonderful hike in, learn about Diana, learn about the Succession Trail, but also see Chicago across the lake. So that, again, just go to indianadunes.com and learn about the Diana of the Dunes there. The other thing we want to remind people of is that so many of us, Chris, have four-legged furry friends, be it a cat or a dog, and we see a lot of people actually walk their cats in the dunes. But we do have the dogs are welcomed at the Indiana Dunes National and State Park. And we have a lot of places that are very pet-friendly, and there's this new Bark Ranger program through the National Park. And so we want to encourage people to get out and enjoy the trails and the beaches, but you can also do it with your four-legged friend. There are two places that dogs are not allowed, or three, any of the lifeguarded beaches when the beach season is open, and then also Glenwood Dune Trail because that's a horseback trail. Mm-hmm. But outside of that, they're welcomed, and we want to encourage people to take advantage of the Bark Ranger program. And then the final one is we have a volunteer drop-in program. And Chris, this is a great opportunity for people to help make a difference in our parks. And that is either picking up trash or every third Saturday of the month from 9 a.m. to noon, you can go to the National Park Volunteer Office, and they're going to have some opportunities for you to get into the dunes and do some projects that from, you know, removing invasive plants to picking up trash, but being able to help restore habitats. So there are so many things for both visitors as well as residents to do this this year in terms of some things that are new that maybe they didn't know about.
Lorelei, if you will give us the web address again so people can check out. It's a very expansive website, and you're liable to find things in there that surprise you and events that surprise you as well, and you have to make note of so you can be sure to come up to Northwest Indiana to check them out.
Yeah, it's indianadunes.com, and you said it best, Chris. It's a very comprehensive website. We encourage both visitors and residents. I think sometimes, Chris, as we as residents, we forget what we have in our own backyard, and we want to encourage our residents to do the same things that we're asking visitors to do. And in fact, we would love our residents to become those ambassadors to their visiting friends and relatives. And before, when your friends and relatives come, instead of thinking immediately, what can I do outside of our area, think about all the great things you can do within your area, which is taking advantage of the dunes, but also supporting your local businesses.
Lorelei Weimer is the Executive Director of the Indiana Dunes Tourism. Thanks for being with us today, Lorelei, and the best of luck as we go into the spring and summer seasons and hopefully more tourists coming back into the region, too.
Well, thank you, Chris. I always appreciate your giving us an opportunity to share this great story.
Indiana Landmarks is once again going to make its Logs to Lustrons talk available if you go online this year. And some interesting conversations will come about from the next event, which is coming up on May 20th. And let's find out more about not only the event, but about the homes that are there, which are along Lake Michigan. We have with us today Brad Miller. He's the director of the Indiana Landmarks Northwest Indiana Field Office, which is based, of course, in Miller, just literally down the lakeshore from the state, from the national park. And Brad, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, first, for people that may or may not be familiar with the Logs to Lustrons talk, I guess you have to bring up both Logs and Lustrons. Let's get both of those in the conversation and what in turn is going to happen for this year's event.
Definitely. So each year, I'm in partnership with Indiana Dunes National Park. We host an in-person tour of architecturally significant buildings in the national park. Obviously, last year and this year, we weren't able to have those in-person events due to COVID, but we are able to offer a talk to really highlight what we do in that tour, which is look at the architectural legacy of Indiana Dunes National Park. And that really spans, you know, from early 19th century log structures all the way up to modern homes, including Lustron homes, which were a very unique post-World War II all-steel prefabbed home. And they only produced, you know, I think 5,000 to 7,000 across the whole country. And Indiana Dunes National Park is lucky to have two of those.
Well, it's good to hear. I know that the idea of prefab homes is not new. In fact, I've lived and worked in a community that had a factory that did nothing but that on assembly line basis, actually creating prefabricated homes that would go up on site. So it's not a new affair to have these built. But certainly Lustrons are a very unique type of construction of a house, aren't they?
You know, it was after World War II. We had lots of steel we didn't know what to do with. So why not make a house completely out of steel, inside and outside? So, you know, that's really what we're trying to highlight, how architecture has evolved over the years. Log structures, wood frame structures, brick farmhouses. We have plenty of those throughout Northwest Indiana, specifically in the Indiana Dunes, primarily tied to the early Swedish communities that moved here in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. So it's a great opportunity to get people out and refamiliarize them with a lot of the landmarks that might just be in their backyard.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I know this year's event on May 20th is going to highlight a couple couples that are going to share their experiences in revitalizing two different homes, two different types of homes. Will you go down the list and tell us about the Szymanskis and with Snells, what they're going to talk about on the event coming up?
They're both part of an interesting partnership program we have with the National Park, where we actually lease these buildings from the National Park Service, and then we sublease them to private families that then restore them, and turn the chance to live in these interesting buildings. So the Szymanskis will be highlighting the restoration of the Oscar and Irene Nelson house, which is an early 19th century log house that's been added on to many times, so you don't really see the logs on the outside anymore. But it's a beautiful old homestead. And then the Snell family actually restored their Lustron home around the Beverly Shores neighborhood. And they actually disassembled their Lustron, moved it, and then reassembled it, just like you would have back in the 1940s. So two very, very different buildings with two different stories, and it's going to be a great time.
And I understand, too, that that one of your colleagues from Indiana Landmarks is going to spend some time talking about the architecture that people probably see, but maybe don't really notice that they're at the Indiana Dunes National Park.
Yeah, and actually, if you tune in, you'll be listening to me. Mm-hmm. So we'll be going through and pointing out some of those buildings. You know, if Indiana Dunes National Park headquarters is actually a reused former Nike missile base, built in the simple international style. So those are things maybe people don't know. Or we'll do take a quick look at U.S. Steel's Goodfellow Lodge and Youth Camp, which was a summer camp that's now part of Indiana Dunes National Park, where the youth from steelworkers would go for retreats in the summer. So it's a really interesting place to talk about.
Now, will you tell us more about how the setup is going to be for the May 20th, virtual Logs to Lustrons talk?
We'll have a one-hour program, and you can register online at our website, www.indianalandmarks.org. You sign up and register, It's free for members and $7 for non-members. And we'll have set up as a Zoom webinar, and you can hop on, listen, and we'll actually have a chance at the end, about 15 minutes, to do a Q&A. So if you have any curious questions about Lost Ron homes or log homes or another historic building in Indiana Dunes National Park, we'd be happy to try and answer those for you.
Brad Miller is the director of the Indiana Dunes Northwest Field Office, which is based in the Miller neighborhood of Gary. And we're talking about the May 20th Logs to Lustrons virtual tour number 2. This year, again, because of the pandemic, it's being viewed online on Zoom. And Brad, thanks for joining us, telling us all about the event coming up. And we hope that, as you did last year, that you have a good attendance for the event.
Thank you so much, Chris.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.